Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Coming up, winning the hearts of Americans to be president of the United States seems harder than ever. The Taliban in Afghanistan have a new leader. U.S. President Obama is in Japan for talks on U.S. crimes in Okinawa, the G7 meeting, and a visit to Hiroshima. And a new film about the difficult situation for Sherpas leading climbers to their dreams on Mount Everest.
The documentary highlights the inequity and the cultural rift between the Sherpas, who see the climb as a pilgrimage, and the Westerners as a challenge.
It's on International Edition. Well, the race for the White House does not seem to be simmering down at all. New developments concerning Clinton's email use and angry demonstrations against Trump are keeping things hot. Senior National Affairs correspondent Jim Malone is here at the anchor desk to help us sort it all out. Nice to see you again, Jim.
Hi, Susan.
Oh, we got breaking news today. Former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is now being faulted by the State Department about her use of a personal email server during her time in office. What are these latest accusations about? And it sounds like good fodder for her opponents.
Yes, on the latter, for sure. The State Department Inspector General has come out with a report that says that while Secretary of State Hillary Clinton did not comply with the agency's policies on keeping records on the way you go about communicating through the use of email, you'll recall she had her own private server set up, which has generated quite a bit of controversy and has been dogging her in the campaign. Well, this report today will further dog her, I'll say. It's sort of a reprimand, if you will. It does say that before Clinton, some of the secretaries of state before her were also using private email systems. But in the case of Clinton, that was her sole use and means of communication. So they're faulting her there. As you can expect, Republicans were quick to jump on this, to highlight the fact that now she's being called into question by the State Department Inspector General. Democrats were trying to rally to her defense, and the Clinton campaign says, well, as it's pointed out in the report, other secretaries of state had started this precedent, but certainly the extent to which Clinton relied on private email and the way it sort of violated the Federal Records Act has become a problem.
And this has not been stated as a crime. They're just noting it. But you remember way back when Bernie Sanders, her opponent, said, he used bad language, but he said basically he didn't want to hear anything more about the emails?
Yeah, we often wonder now if he regrets saying that. We should clarify here that there are other pending things going on related to this. There's an FBI investigation of possible criminal wrongdoing, which looks at whether any information, classified information, was jeopardized. The nightmare scenario there for Democrats would be some sort of indictment. There's been no suggestion that's going to happen. In fact, most legal analysts disregard that possibility. But here's the problem, I think, for Mrs. Clinton. This kind of plays into that narrative that she continues to be dogged by these problems about her use of personal email while Secretary of State gives fodder to her critics. And also, Susan, it comes at a critical time. She's trying to wrap up the Democratic nomination. She's far ahead, but they've got a critical primary coming up in California on June 7th, where her rival, Bernie Sanders, is competitive. She desperately wants to win that to show she has momentum going into the convention, and this may not help her do that.
Oh, I don't think so. But meanwhile, over in the Republican camp, presumptive presidential nominee Donald Trump, he is dealing with some really violent protests. In New Mexico, it was amazing. Tear gas and smoke bombs and everything else.
Yeah, officers on horseback trying to restrain the crowd. They broke through a barricade. A few got in to disrupt the rally. Trump, as is his wont, made fun of them, kind of heckled at them himself. I guess this is a taste of, you know, we've seen this through the primaries, and I think it's likely to get even more so as we move toward the general election. New Mexico is an important case, a high Hispanic population there, the highest in the country. And also, it's a what we call a swing state. It's a battleground state where both parties feel they have a shot. I think if when Trump goes into some of these states with high Democratic populations, he will be facing protests.
Well, thanks, Jim. Always appreciate your insight.
Sure, you bet.
Joining us here in the studio with what is being said on the web about this story is social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky. Welcome, Andrew. What we got going?
Well, the term State Department is trending on social media as a lot of people are talking about this State Department report. And as often is the case when we talk about these political stories, it's kind of a choose-your-own-adventure. For Hillary Clinton's supporters, they're saying, we are still supporting her. This was an error. It wasn't necessarily criminal. Let's move past it. Let's focus on the issues. And then you have on the other side, you have Bernie Sanders supporters saying, well, Donald Trump's going to beat her, so let's support Bernie. Donald Trump supporters saying Donald Trump's going to beat her, and that's why we're supporting Donald Trump. So you see kind of everybody move into their corners of who they're supporting and try to amp that up with this news. But we'll see as this plays out on social media, we'll see how those attitudes continue, and surely they will.
And you were mentioning something I think that is interesting today is also a little glug glug here on a lighter note. Clinton's going to need some of this tonight.
Perhaps. It is hashtag National Wine Day. Our colleague Steve Miller, he asked, is it W-H-I-N-E, like complaining? I said, no, it's wine like the beverage. So we're seeing a lot of people celebrating that on social media, Wednesday Wines Day, as they say. But a lot of talk about the health benefits of wine. There have been multiple studies saying moderate drinking can be beneficial, especially red wine. So people saying, well, I'm definitely going to take part in that tonight, and it's for my health. That's what they keep saying. But a fun midweek holiday, you know, as we always talk about on the show, these days that pop up, whether it's related to food or animals or things, always great opportunities on social media for people to kind of run with it, whether it's advertising a product or just making some funny jokes. And this certainly is the case for National Wine Day. So if anyone's celebrating out there, cheers and hope you enjoy.
Cheers to all of you. Thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
We invite you all to follow us on the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Top of the news, the U.S. State Department finds Hillary Clinton at fault for failing to follow the department's guidelines to avoid cybersecurity risks. Afghanistan's Taliban appoints a new chief following the death of Mullah Akhtar Mansour. The U.S. and Japanese leaders speak out about the murder of a Japanese woman in Okinawa. News, feature reports, and more are at voanews.com. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A group of astronomers probing a young star cluster just found a bunch of huge monster stars. The star cluster is called R136 and is located about 157,000 light years from Earth. The group used images gathered by the Hubble Space Telescope to detect dozens of stars with at least 50 times the mass of the Sun and about nine others with more than 100 times the solar mass. The nine most massive of these stars were found to be not only incredibly enormous, but together they produce an extremely bright light that is 30 million times more luminous than the Sun. One of the astronomers said that while some suggest the monster stars were created by the constant merger of smaller binary stars, this doesn't seem to be the case with the supermassive stars in the R136 cluster. Instead, it appears that the road that led to the huge size of these stars may have begun with its formation process. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Just days after a U.S. drone strike killed Taliban leader Mullah Akhtar Massoud in southwest Pakistan, the insurgent group has named its new leadership team with Malawi Habibullah Akhundzada. He is described as a religious scholar and close associate of Mansour's. His deputies are Sirajunda Haqqani and Mullah Muhammad Yaqub, son of the late Taliban founder Mullah Muammar Omar. Thomas Running is a member of the Afghanistan and Analyst Network in Kabul. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty, Habibullah is not well known, but has held top posts in the insurgency since its beginning.
He comes from the Taliban judiciary, in which he served when the Taliban were in power here in Kabul between 1996 and 2001. And he was so far the first deputy leader of Mullah Mansour, who has also now been declared dead officially by the Taliban. And he also serves on their Ulema Council, so that's the Council of the Religious Leaders, which gives religious authority to decisions taken by the Taliban leader. So he's now in both positions. I think the religious authority he incorporates is very important.
Mansoor was taken out by a U.S. drone missile, apparently because, according to U.S. officials, he was posing threats to U.S. forces and Afghan security forces. What can you tell us about this new leader? Will he be any more amenable to some sort of a peace process?
He is coming into the position which Mullah Mansoor just had until recently. He probably would be in the same position like him and be at least politically responsible for planning attacks in Afghanistan. I mean, the military campaign of the Taliban has not been interrupted by that new transition, which also happened much quicker than most of the people expected. I personally think he's something like a centrist in the Taliban movement, and with his religious title, he probably might be approachable for a new attempt to start talks towards a peaceful solution of the conflict. I don't think that he's a radical. You were mentioning the two names of Mullah Yaqub, which is the son of the former Taliban leader Mullah Omar, and of Sirajuddin Haqqani, young hotheads and fighters. I think from the point of the Taliban, the choice of Haibatullah Akhundzada is a wise choice.
What does it tell you his deputies will be Sirajuddin Haqqani and Mullah Yaqub?
Well, I think that gives additional legitimacy to the leadership in the eyes of the Taliban, because you now have the son of the former leader and the founder of the movement as a deputy. He's reportedly still under 30, so probably a bit too young to be the number one. And Sirajuddin Haqqani, also relatively young, the son of famous leader of the former Afghan Mujahideen fighting the Soviets in the 1980s. He also needed to be kept on board because he was already the second deputy of Mullah Mansoor. He represents a network in the southeast of the country in the provinces of Bakhtiar Paktika and Khost, which is not original Taliban country. The Taliban come from the south, from the larger region around Kandahar.
Damiz Rutic says the new leadership team might unify the Taliban, which had been beset by quarrels over the leadership. He says Haibatullah, who is non-controversial and has been out of the limelight, might just be the one who could heal factional rivalries. As the announcement was made public, a suicide attack on a bus carrying judicial staff west of Kabul killed at least 10 people and wounded 4 others. The Taliban. Coming up on International Edition, President Obama faces a difficult topic in Japan. And are Sherpas risking their lives for the financial gain of others? Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe told U.S. President Barack Obama of his country's profound resentment over a former U.S. Marine's confessed involvement in the killing of a Japanese woman. And visiting Okinawa, Obama expressed sincerest condolences and deepest regrets over the murder. Correspondent Steve Herman is following the story from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
Hi, Susan.
Could you give us some background on this situation on the island there with the U.S. workers from the military bases?
Right. U.S. has a very heavy presence on Okinawa. 15 of the 23 U.S. bases in Japan are located on the main island of Okinawa, and the bases encompass about 10% of the total land of the southern prefecture. And there are thousands and thousands of U.S. military personnel, their dependents, and civilian employees there. And any time a crime is committed by one of them, it is headline news all throughout Japan. And, of course, when it's such a serious crime as a homicide, you can imagine it is quite emotional. And this all really harkens back very bitter memories to around 1995, when some Japanese schoolgirls were raped by U.S. military personnel on Okinawa, and that triggered huge demonstrations there against the American bases.
And then more recently, we had this case of the 20-year-old Japanese woman.
She disappeared late last month. Her body was found last week, and a former Marine who is a civilian employee of the U.S. military on Okinawa has been arrested in connection with her death. And this has been practically front-page news every day since his arrest, and of course, that's what prompted Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to want to speak specifically about this to President Obama before the G7 summit got underway.
And bringing up the G7 summit, what are we expecting there?
Well, you get a lot of leaders together for a very short period of time who are supposed to tussle with the world's biggest problems. So we will get some sort of communique touching many issues involving the global economy, the refugee issue, geopolitical matters. Very little has leaked out so far, but we're told from Japanese sources that there will be a relatively blunt statement about the South China Sea and freedom of navigation and all that, but it's not apparently going to mention China by name, but everyone will know it's referring to China.
And then later this week, we have the symbolic visit to Hiroshima by President Obama.
Yes, President Obama will become the first U.S. leader to visit the site of the first atomic bombing. The bomb dropped by the United States military in August 1945, followed by another bombing a couple of days later on Nagasaki as well. So very poignant. The president is not going to apologize for the American action. He will meet with some of the survivors. This is being very much appreciated by the people of Japan and Prime Minister Abe as well.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us today, Steve, from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
You're most welcome, Susan.
This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Ida Keeling first started running marathons over three decades ago. And now, at age 100, she's the new world record holder for the 100-meter dash for her age group. It happened at the Penn Relay in Pennsylvania. Ida crossed the finish line at 1 minute 17 seconds.
A nice example of what you can do for yourself, and I thank God every day for my blessings.
Her daughter and trainer Shelley Keeling says her mother works hard at being so fit.
A lot of her training is not just real, just the pounding on the track, but she has a mat, she doesn't squat, push up.
And Ida has no plans to slow down. Good exercise, fresh grains and produce and food without preservatives, maybe an occasional touch of liquor. It's all part of the life plan of this 100-year-old world track record holder. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
At least four people have died on Mount Everest this week. Three of them amateur climbers and one a Sherpa mountain guide. And he is not the first one. Dozens of Sherpas have lost their lives guiding foreigners to the summit of the world's tallest mountain since 1953, when British expeditioner Edmund Hillary and local Sherpa Tenzin Norgay made the first ascent on Everest. The son of the first Sherpa to reach the top is slamming the mountain climbing industry for exploiting Sherpas who risk their lives for a pittance. VOA's Penelope Palou has more in this report for VOA Television.
On April 18, 2014, filmmaker Jennifer Peedham of the documentary Sherpa captured the worst tragedy that has ever happened on Everest. 16 Sherpas, the native guides of Mount Everest, died in that avalanche. The film focuses on the dangers and hardship the Sherpas endure every climbing season for a fraction of the profit expedition associations and the Nepalese government make at their expense.
Roughing it on Mount Everest. Hot towels and tea in the morning.
And while the visitors are prepping for the climb in their spacious tents, the Sherpas pay their respects to the gods of the mountain, praying for a safe ascent while their families anxiously await their return. Doing anything at this altitude is risky and can be deadly, but lavish summit expeditions designed to make the climb less extreme are the very things that endanger the lives of climbers and Sherpas alike, says Norbu Tenzin Norgay.
My father said, I wish I had never climbed this mountain.
He is the son of Tenzin Norgay, the first Sherpa ever to climb Mount Everest.
Can we reduce that risk? Yes, you know, if people aren't carrying espresso machines and heaters and pads so that the clients can sleep comfortably. Yes, you can reduce the risk.
The documentary highlights the inequity and the cultural rift between the Sherpas, who see the climb as a pilgrimage, and the Westerners as a challenge. Despite the dangers, the Sherpas depend on the expedition business. Each makes about $5,000 a season, while their farming counterparts make $700 a year. But that amount pales next to the $70,000 or $100,000 each climber pays for the trip of his dreams.
Good morning, Dai.
Good morning, Mount Everest.
The lion's share goes to the businesses and the government, says Norbu Tenzing Norgay.
The average Sherpa now gets $15,000 in insurance should something bad happen, and that's up, $5,000 since 2014. But if you go back a number of years, when somebody died on Everest, the average Sherpa was able to build a house, send the kids through school, and have a tea house. And these days, the insurance barely covers the cost of a funeral.
According to the documentary, the April 2014 avalanche was the last straw.
16 people dying at the same time, it's a huge, huge shock. When it started to sink in, the anger got distinctly pointed at the government. They feel that the government has always been benefiting off the labor of the Sherpas, the lives of the Sherpas, and never put anything back.
To try to get more control over their fate, many Sherpas are beginning to bypass climbing businesses to start their own expeditions. Their goal is to control the experience and keep themselves and climbers safe, if not comfortable, on a mountain they revere. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us today for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Treasury Department has put in place sanctions against Libyan Speaker and President of the House of Representatives, Aguila Saleh Issa, for undermining the political transition in Libya. As a result of this designation, all property and interests in property of Mr. Issa that are within the jurisdiction of the United States or in the control of U.S. citizens are blocked, and Americans are generally prohibited from engaging in transactions with him. Aguila Saleh Issa is responsible for stalling political progress in Libya, and this action sends a clear message that the U.S. government will continue to target those who undermine the peace, security, and stability of Libya, said John Smith, acting director of the Office of Foreign Assets Control. We will continue to support Libya's government of national accord and its efforts to build a better and more stable future for the Libyan people. Mr. Issa repeatedly blocked votes by the House of Representatives needed to support Libya's political transition. In October 2015, Mr. Issa presided over a legislative session that was scheduled to hold a vote to endorse the Libyan political agreement and the Government of National Unity, or GNA. The session ended prematurely because Mr. Issa listed four new conditions for the legislature to approve the GNA, then departed, forestalling a vote. In early November 2015, the House of Representatives' vote was again postponed due to Mr. Issa's trip to Saudi Arabia, which appears to have been another deliberate act to prevent a vote on the Government of National Accord. Despite repeated Libyan calls to hold the vote, Mr. Issa began to travel again as part of his delay tactics. On January 25, 2016, the House finally voted to ratify the Libyan political agreement and endorse the Presidency Council. Since that time, however, Mr. Issa has prevented a vote on the Government of National Accord's cabinet, despite broad support for the cabinet by the membership of the House of Representatives and in violation of the Libyan political agreement. The United States fully supports Libya's Government of National Accord and will not tolerate actions by individuals who undermine the political transition in Libya.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.